Hello, you're listening to Gossipint, the way to gossip intelligently. Gossipint is a podcast that helps listeners learn critical thinking concepts by applying them to well-known pop culture events and real-world technology-focused examples. Here with us today, we have Diana Duvielle, Karen Frost, and Caitlin Hopkins. And I'm your host, Bobby Jane. Details on our backgrounds can be found in the podcast bio. Although all participants today work at Microsoft, the views expressed here belong to us alone and do not represent the views of Microsoft. Welcome to our creative and imaginative world of Gossipint. Welcome back. Did you guys know that this is our 20th episode? I think we've learned a lot over these 20 episodes, and I hope our listeners have too. Diana's kicking us off today. Thank you for starting us off. Tell us what our cognitive bias is today.
Today, we are talking about authority bias. Authority bias is our tendency to attribute greater accuracy and weight to the opinion of an authority figure just because they're an authority figure. Put more plainly, it's when we give more credence to the opinions of an authority figure than we should. That might sound a little odd at first, even paradoxical. Why wouldn't we trust an authority? I mean, they're an authority for a reason, right? But after listening to the following examples, I think you might see why we shouldn't always trust so-called authorities. In a 2000 study, psychiatrist Charles Hoffling found that 21 out of 22 nurses would have given patients a potentially fatal dose of a drug when asked by a doctor, even though this instruction would go against the official guidance forbidding the drug from being administered. What was wrong with these nurses? Were they hard-headed and obstinate? No, they were trusting. They trusted the man in the lab coat who told them to do it. But Hoffling probably knew this would be the outcome before he even started, all because of the Milgram experiment. Even if you haven't heard the name Milgram, you may be familiar with the story. In 1961, Yale University psychologist Stanley Milgram conducted a study to measure the willingness of study participants to obey an authority figure who instructed them to perform something against their personal conscience. In this case, that act against conscience was administering electric shocks to someone else every time that person, called a learner, got a test question wrong. These were fake electric shocks, which the study participants believed were real, and they gradually increased to levels that would have been fatal had they been real. The learner, who was an actor, screamed, begged, pretended to pass out, and yet the study participants still continued to administer the shocks. The experiment found that a shockingly high proportion of test subjects, 40 men between ages 20 to 50, from a diverse range of occupations and with varying levels of education, obeyed the instructions to continue issuing the shocks, even when they believed they were seriously harming the learner. Every single participant administered 300 volts, and 65% administered the full 450 volts, which they could see was marked at a rating higher than severe shock. Study participants continued to administer shocks even when they thought the learner was unresponsive and possibly dead. The participants could have refused to continue giving shocks at any time. There was absolutely nothing stopping them. So why didn't they? The study participants weren't emotionless psychopaths. They sweated, shivered, groaned, and laughed nervously. Three had seizures. They knew what they were doing was wrong. They felt terrible about it even, and yet, someone in a lab coat told them to do something, so they did it. They obeyed the orders of an authority over their own sense of right and wrong. Milgram wanted to understand and explain the psychology of genocide. He was looking at the Holocaust in particular. We know why Hitler did what he did, but what about all his followers? Why did thousands of people engage in terrible, heinous crimes like genocide? Why was there so little resistance to this objectively awful behavior? The answer is because the Germans were told to by authority figures, and Milgram proved that.
This seems like such an extremely strong cognitive effect, stronger with more serious implications than many of the other topics we've discussed in the podcast. I wonder why this one's so strong within us, causing us to take such unbelievable action.
If you're thinking Milgram's experiment was a fluke or limited to some particular category of people like men or Americans, it's not. This experiment has been repeated many times around the globe with rather consistent results. We humans are primed by nurture and maybe even by nature to have a deep-seated tendency to obey authority. When you think about it, from birth, we're trained to follow the commands of other people, elders, teachers, bosses. It's ingrained in us to do as we're told. And what's more, some societies, such as in Eastern Europe or Asia, are more likely to accept the automatic legitimacy of authority than others.
Well, that's really interesting. So did all the participants go all the way with the experiments and did they all give really high shocks?
No. And I want to highlight that we don't comply with all orders equally. I don't know if this makes me feel better, but Milgram found that the percent of study participants who delivered the highest strength shock dropped from 65% to only 20% when the person instructing the study participants to do so was in regular clothes and not a white lab coat. In addition, 70% of the participants refused to go to the highest shock strength when they were forced to physically push the learner's hand onto a shock plate. This still leaves a scary 30% compliance rate and probably explains things like the guards in the Nazi concentration camps. Anyway, this authority bias can be seen as a perfect storm of three factors. When we assume that authority figures are legitimate, that they have some relative degree of power, and that they have the right to demand our obedience. Another variation of authority bias comes when we believe that these figures have more knowledge or skills than we do. For example, police or doctors, most of us are predisposed to have a higher degree of trust for the entire profession. That trust then applies automatically to anyone professing to be part of that cadre.
Okay, so the authority figure has to have some level of credibility in a person's mind, but we do have the ability to discern what we find credible then, right?
Yeah. For example, let's say you see a TV ad for a new vitamin supplement, which a man in a lab coat endorses the product. If you take it, he says you'll have all sorts of positive benefits. Sounds great. That must be true if a doctor says it. But then you read the small print on the screen and it says the man in the lab coat is a paid actor, not a doctor. Are you as excited about that vitamin supplement now? You've just become a living example of Milgram's second discovery. You trusted the man in the lab coat until he took it off.
Okay, so avoid authority figures is what I'm hearing. But more realistically, how do we avoid this particular bias? I don't really feel like I want to be giving people electric shocks.
Remember how last episode we talked about the third person effect?
Yeah, and you had my head bouncing back and forth.
I have bad news for you. Before Milgram's experiment, he ran a poll asking how many test subjects in 100 the poll takers thought would deliver the maximum strength shock. The average guess was 1 in 100. Or 1%. In reality, the number was 65%. Reading about the Milgram experiment, we might be tempted to think, oh, I would never shock someone just because someone told me to. I would stop once the other person was in pain. But the truth is, every single test subject shocked the learner to at least the severe shock level, and more than half shocked the learner to a level marked as fatal. So what this means is that no matter what you think about yourself, if the man in the lab coat told you to do something, you would, to some degree or another.
I wonder if this holds up in today's society. If we were given the same poll today, would we think the majority of people would shock the learner, or would they stop? Has our opinion of the fellow members of society changed, or has society actually changed?
We would probably be as optimistic as the original poll takers and be just as surprised when we were proven wrong. Society hasn't really changed. I mean, remember, it's only been a few decades since Milgram's experiment. We still are conditioned to respect and obey authority, even when it seems wrong, and always will be. But to get back to your question about trying to mitigate our susceptibility to authority bias, step one is always to recognize the possible presence of authority bias. For example, if we're pulled over by a policeman for speeding, we should certainly stop and listen to what the officer has to say. However, if that policeman does not show a badge, his car is not a marked police car, and he makes a strange demand, we might want to consider whether the individual is only imitating a police officer. Perhaps he actually intends some nefarious activity, like robbery or rape, and is relying on our respect for authority to manipulate us.
Okay, so first we have to determine if the authority figure is authentic.
I would frame it as determine how much authority to give a figure. The figure can be authentic, which is to say he could be a real police officer, but that doesn't mean we should obey mindlessly if they're acting in a way that suggests we shouldn't listen to them. Another action is to create distance from the authority figure. Milgram found that study participants were more likely to refuse orders to deliver more shocks when they were not in the same room as the authority figure giving the order. In our case, the distance we're seeking could be one of either time or distance. Take a moment after listening to an authority figure to think through what they've asked of you, then make a decision about whether to comply or not. You can also remind yourself that not all authority figures give legitimate orders, and not all authority figures should have authority. The less legitimate you believe an authority figure is, the less likely you will be to follow their commands. By asking yourself where they get their authority from and what power they hold over you, you may find that they're actually a false authority. And as a final note, if you're in a position of authority, it may help to be aware of how you are inadvertently creating authority bias in others. If you are the senior person on a work team, for example, consider doing things like encouraging questions that may challenge your expertise or your processes. You want to do as much as possible to break down that bias.
All right. Thank you, Diana. That was really interesting. It seems like there are many different dynamics at play here. All right, Karen, let's dive into my favorite topic, pop culture. What example are you sharing with us today?
You might be surprised to know just how many examples of authority bias exist in pop culture. Do you remember the movie Catch Me If You Can with Leonardo DiCaprio? The movie is based on a book by Frank Abagnale, who claims that before his 19th birthday, he had successfully pulled off cons worth millions of dollars by posing as a pilot, a doctor, and a prosecutor, all positions that would naturally lower the guards of the people around him due to their high authority factor. Now, it turns out that he was lying about absolutely everything, but there are other people, plenty of other people, who had similar but real exploits. For example, William Hammond was a pilot who masqueraded as a cardiologist despite having had only a few years of medical school. He trained medical staff, published papers, and gave talks to other doctors for 15 years before he was caught.
Wow, so this guy puts on a white coat and voila, everyone believes he's a doctor? That's wild.
Basically. Of course, Hammond had some training and knew the lingo. He was very well respected in the medical community, so he likely was very smart and was able to pass very convincingly. His work doesn't appear to have resulted in harm to anyone, but the same can't be said for O'Neill Ron Morris. Morris pretended to be an in-home plastic surgeon for transgender women. In the course of Morris's fake practice, she injected her victims with substances such as Fix-A-Flat, rubber cement, caulk, and industrial-strength silicone, ultimately killing one person. Why did anyone let the toxic tush doctor into their home, leaving them disfigured and in pain? You guessed it, authority bias.
Wow, that one is wild. She was a never licensed doctor and used deadly mixtures of silicone, superglue, mineral oil, sealant, and cement. In the articles, they still referred to her victims as patients when they should have just simply called them victims.
Right. You can't really be a patient of someone who's not a doctor, can you? Diana mentioned how criminals can leverage the authority bias by posing as police officers during the commission of a crime. You've probably seen this in dozens of heist movies. The robbers dress as police officers or armored car drivers. Anything that has a whiff of authority or hierarchy. This gives the thieves the equivalent of a cloak of invisibility or a golden key. No one dares question them, even when they march off with millions of dollars. In real life, this really does happen. In fact, it's even what occurred during the most notorious art theft of all time. In March 1990, two thieves posing as police officers entered the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum under the guise of investigating alarm bells being triggered. After handcuffing the two security guards, they made off with $500 million in artwork, including Rembrandt's The Storm on the Sea of Galilee, Vermeer's The Concert, and works by Degas, Manet, and Flink. The guards had opened the door to let the thieves in because they trusted the uniforms. If the thieves had come dressed in regular street clothes, you can imagine how differently the scenario would have played out. The case has never been solved, and the 13 works of art that were stolen have never been recovered. Interestingly, experts believe the concert may be the most valuable stolen object in the world. Since the statute of limitations expired in 1995, the thieves could walk up to the museum holding the paintings and they couldn't be prosecuted. It would be impossible to sell the paintings through normal channels, though, because they're too famous. So I like to imagine they're in the private collections of some ultra-rich who bought them in a nefarious art black market, rather than sitting in some attic collecting dust. If you're interested in this case, by the way, it's popped up in multiple TV shows, is discussed in several books, and now you can watch a four-part documentary on Netflix called This is a Robbery, the World's Biggest Art Heist.
Netflix has the best documentaries. We love Netflix.
Yes. Another fantastic art documentary on Netflix is Made You Look, about the largest art forgery scandal in U.S. history. The film tells the story of how the Knoedler Gallery in New York City sold $80 million worth of forged paintings, allegedly by Jackson Pollock, Mark Rothko, and Robert Motherwell. How did the various players in this real-life situation get duped? You're not going to believe this, but one of the major components was authority bias. If an expert in art history tells you a painting is a Rothko, who are you to disagree, even if there are reasons to doubt its authenticity? In this situation, the bias comes more from trust in someone else's expertise than compliance bred from social hierarchy, but the effect is the same. And the victims aren't just the non-experts who bought the paintings from the gallery. Anne Friedman, the gallery president and director, claimed that she too was duped. For example, the leading expert on Rothko declared one of the paintings she sold to be genuine. How could she be blamed for believing him? I really like this documentary, and I do recommend it in part because it asks us, what is art?
Right. So the authority can also simply just be a figure who is a professional in our minds, like the authority on a specific topic that we care about.
Right. The last thing I want to talk about today has to do with cults. For decades, cults have intersected regularly with pop culture. For one thing, even celebrities sometimes get caught up in them. Michelle Pfeiffer, Shirley MacLaine, Joaquin Phoenix, and Jane Fonda, just to name a few. Other celebrities have had close brushes with cult leaders. For example, Beach Boys member Charlie Wilson once let the Manson family live in his home, while Neil Young tried to get Charles Manson a record deal. And for any geriatric millennials like us, former teen heartthrob Andrew Keegan from Seventh Heaven and 10 Things I Hate About You runs his own cult in LA called Full Circle.
That I did not know. An active cult today? Wow.
Yes, although it seems to be a perfectly harmless cult full of modern day hippies, so don't get the wrong impression here. Another more recognizable way cults intersect with pop culture is when they make headline news. Most recently, this has been the NXIVM cult, but the Manson family, Heaven's Gate, the Moonies, the Children of God, and Jonestown have all been longstanding subjects of popular interest due to the prominence they received both at the time and subsequently. These cults are absorbed into various parts of pop culture, reemerging in song references, movies by Quentin Tarantino, and Netflix docuseries. If anyone watched Keep Sweet, Pray and Obey, you know what I'm talking about.
The Charles Manson story is really wild to me for how many people actually interacted with him prior to the cult killing 9 people. And then the Jonestown Massacre is the largest suicide in history with over 900 people dead. I'm sure you guys know that's where the term drink the Kool-Aid comes from. By the way, it's probably terrible and we probably should not be using that term anymore.
I don't know which is better known to Americans, the Manson family murders or the Jonestown Massacre. Both serve as warnings for what happens when cults turn deadly and when members uncritically follow their leaders, even to the point of committing murder or suicide. Now, cults are an extremely complex topic, and I want to stress that only a small percent of them are actually dangerous to people outside the group. There are plenty of cults that are focused on things like trying to make the world a better place through peaceful prayer, selling crystals and kombucha, which is a reference to Andrew Keegan's cult, by the way. But I want to focus on how the authority bias plays into some cults. Specifically, we're going to talk about the leaders of what are described as totalitarian cults or destructive cults. These are cults that are highly manipulative and exploit their members, psychologically and sometimes physically damaging them. Over the course of their experiences in the cult, members undergo behavioral and personality changes, become estranged from their family, and exchange their personal identity for a sort of mindless following of the leader. But how did these members get there? How does a regular person like me or you find themselves in a situation in which they're asked to do morally repugnant things, like sexually abuse children or murder strangers, and they comply? Can we find any parallels here with Milgram's experiment? Again, this is a very complex issue with a variety of factors that has been studied extensively by experts. But I would suggest that perhaps at some point, for some people, authority bias comes into play.
Per your question that you posed, I keep thinking of Diana's third person bias point, and I'm sitting here soundly confident that I would never join a cult, whereas I believe other people are much more susceptible.
It's true that the number of people who join cults are a small percentage of the population. That said, one could argue that there are plenty of similarities between cults and other groups with authority figures. Have you heard that joke that CrossFit is a cult, for example? What if your gym developed a cult of personality around the gym owner? How do you avoid giving that person undue legitimacy and authority when you're swept up in the communal feeling? But anyway, to get back to this idea of cults and authority bias, members view the cult leader as an authority figure. This figure has power over them, perceived legitimacy, and the right to demand obedience from their followers. That recipe Diana noted for danger. While the authority bias alone doesn't turn someone into a murderer, might it be one of the many factors that enables totalitarian cult leaders to get their followers to do bad deeds that would normally go against their conscience? I'm no expert, but it makes sense to me. And it reinforces why we need to be on guard against the ability of authority bias to overcome our natural inhibitions. Did you see the movie Pain and Gain? What I'm saying is, if your CrossFit gym owner tries to convince you to engage in a new life of crime, it may be time to say no and look for a new gym.
Karen, thank you for always coming in hot and serious with the more depressing topics. Caitlin, you are going to be walking us through a tech topic. Can I count on you for something a little less morbid?
I can go a little less morbid for a tech topic today, yes. But first, I want to add my own commentary on authority bias in policing. Like Karen and Diana have already mentioned, the criminal justice system in general is a really good place to look for examples of authority bias. Think about it. A police department is a very hierarchical and military-esque organization. A large part of the structure, at least historically, is that officers believe, obey, and defend their authority figures. If you think about it, this bias, among many other reasons, may be part of why institutions like the police are so slow to change. The people who are in positions of authority are generally older and have more archaic beliefs and opinions. But junior officers, who may have more innovative and modern ideas, are uncomfortable challenging that authority. The natural hierarchy of the force, you know, sergeant, lieutenant, captain, etc., further reinforces authority bias, slowing the pace at which ideological and therefore societal change can be made. But there are other ways that authority bias rears its head in criminal justice, and one of which is in expert testimony. Here's an example. In December 1986, a woman left a bar in Louisiana to go get food at a restaurant. As she got out of her car, she saw a piece of paper on her windshield and stuffed it in her pocket. As she did, a man came up behind her and forced her into his car. There, he bit her, raped her, and then dropped her off in a nearby neighborhood. The woman went to the police, and during their investigation, they looked at the piece of paper from the windshield. It was a bank receipt for a man named Willie Jackson. After the victim identified Jackson in both a photo lineup and a live lineup, Jackson was charged with the rape. During the trial, a forensic odontologist, or someone who applies dental evidence in criminal and civil law, testified that the bite marks on the victim matched Jackson's teeth. He said, "My conclusion is that Mr. Jackson is the person who bit this lady." But during the course of the trial, Jackson's defense team presented a slew of opposing evidence, including a confession by Jackson's own brother, Milton, that he, not Willie, committed the rape. Eyewitness testimony from the bar stating that it was Milton, not Willie, who was in the bar that night, and the fact that the victim stated her attacker complained about serving in the military, a past job that Milton had, again, not Willie. Still, despite all this opposing evidence and a literal confession by Milton, Willie was still found guilty beyond a reasonable doubt of raping that woman. The aura of authority that the forensic odontologist, an expert witness, had overpowered all the other evidence that the jury heard. This just shows how powerful authority bias is, something that should concern us all, should we ever get roped up in Jackson's position. If you're wondering whether Jackson was eventually exonerated, the answer is yes. But it wasn't until 2004, when DNA testing was done on biological evidence collected from the victim's clothing. Jackson spent 17 years in prison, in part because of authority bias.
Caitlin, thank you. Yes, so much less depressing. 17 years wrongfully convicted? That's absolutely horrible. Thank goodness for the Innocence Project and the debunking of the junk science, such as the one you mentioned.
Exactly. Now to move on to tech. Bobby Jane, have you ever heard of the crypto king Sam Bankman-Fried? I think he's an interesting example of how authority can look different in different industries and how authority bias can play out in the tech world.
So I know the crypto king. I know he's made a lot of enemies.
You're right. I would definitely say so. Sam Bankman-Fried, also known by his initials SBF, was an MIT graduate. In 2019, he founded FTX, a cryptocurrency derivatives exchange. When Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies boomed during the bull run of 2021, SBF worked hard to promote FTX as a trustworthy financial institution led by an eccentric tech genius. Now, how exactly did he promote himself as such? Well, he leaned into the celebrity techie billionaire archetype that we've seen throughout Silicon Valley and beyond. Eccentric, genius, and oddly charismatic. And apart from just his physical appearance, an unkempt roll out of bed hairstyle, shorts, a t-shirt, a hoodie, and untied shoes, SBF also acted eccentrically. In fact, according to a blog post from Sequoia Capital, SBF played League of Legends, a video game, during a high-level video call with the venture capital company's investment team. Only a genius would be that eccentric, right? The company proceeded to invest over $200 million in FTX.
This is giving Elizabeth Holmes vibes, just with a different look.
You're right. It's like same word, different font. Diana and Karen talked about authority coming from uniforms. White lab coats or law enforcement uniforms. For con men, authority often comes from showing up in a snazzy business suit. If you look sharp, you must be rich and therefore good at business, right? But recently, our tech geniuses are supposed to be eccentric and outlandish. Moving away from the Steve Jobs and Bill Gates of the world, today they smoke marijuana in front of investors. They go on yoga retreats. SBF found a new uniform to wear. The nerdy guy everyone in high school assumed must be secretly brilliant, just disengaged. But whether SBF really is a genius or not is completely irrelevant, because what he was actually doing was running a massive Ponzi scheme. SBF had a backdoor programmed into the FTX exchange that allowed him to move customer money from FTX to the crypto investing firm he owned called Alameda Research. The house of cards quickly came crashing down when the con was exposed, and SBF went from being the crypto king to detainee facing federal charges of wire fraud and conspiracy. Why did people invest in SBF's projects and believe him? Right before the spectacular implosion of the Ponzi scheme, SBF was valued at a net worth of $26.5 billion, making him one of the wealthiest people in the world. FTX itself was valued at $32 billion. SBF hired celebrities like Tom Brady, Stephen Curry, Shaquille O'Neal, and Larry David to act as spokespeople for the exchange and bought the rights to rename the Miami Heat Arena the FTX Arena. All of this looked legitimate. Surely, all these celebrities and businesses wouldn't have done business with a con man, right? If there's a lesson here, I'm starting to wonder if it's trust no one. Whether it's slick men in suits or frumpy tech wonder kids in shorts and sandals, there are many people that seem authoritative who simply aren't.
Thank you. Also, it's like the layers of people who seemingly trusted him. The New York Times hosted him as a speaker alongside the president of Ukraine and Mark Zuckerberg. And if they're all sitting alongside him, then it seems he's pretty legit, right? So something else to think about when it comes to authority bias is how authority or legitimacy can be inadvertently conferred by proxy. So in conclusion, we want to be aware of our natural, deep-rooted, very strong bias towards authority and be aware of the type of positions we discern to be authoritative. So that wraps up today's episode. Join us next time as we'll be talking about mirror image thinking. I think I can guess what this one is, but I'll wait till next time to hear about it from the trusted sources here on Gossip Int.